You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi. Welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Amy Tan, the author of The 100 Secret Senses, recently published by Putnam. And she's the author, of course, of The Joy Luck Club and The Kitchen God's Wife. And I wanted to begin by acknowledging that, to my mind, The Joy Luck Club was one of those perfect books. It just seemed to me to be both literary and meaningful as well to a huge audience of people. It didn't shut people out by being of great quality. The 100 Secret Senses comes, and nowhere on it does it say a novel. And I suddenly wondered, how did that happen? How did it go out unclassified?
Oh, God, I didn't even notice.
Nowhere. And not on the book flap, not on the cover, not on the title page.
It could be set next to 101 Dalmatians or 99 Trick Pull Shots or something, I guess, you know. 100 Secret Senses, how to discover them and cultivate them to your... Yeah, no, I...
It wasn't anyone's choice. Uh-huh. It just somehow...
No. I don't think it occurred to anybody that it should be, would have to be distinguished from... a nonfiction book.
Oh, no.
But I assure you, Michael, it's not autobiography. It's not a memoir. And it's not a how-to.
No, I know that. I'm curious, what have you learned about novel writing? The first time around, The Joy Luck Club was started as a collection of short stories.
Yes, right.
And The Kitchen God's Wife had more of the character, say, of Chronicle.
Right.
History. Mm-hmm. And this seems to be very interested in being a novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, I always considered The Kitchen God's Wife to be my first novel. And some of it was fairly much set because of it being based on my mother's life. This one really required me to go to those outer limits of imagination and think about structure. But at the same time, it was very organic in how it happened. I would simply start writing and see what direction that the novel took me to. And I got to a certain point in which the story seemed to want to shift back to an earlier period. It's a story that takes place 140 years ago. And that story kept getting longer and longer, and it was toward the end of the book. And my editor, Faith Sale, looked at that, and I said, there's perhaps too much coming too late. That's what my writer's group says, and maybe I should condense it. And she said, no, there's a lot of really rich material there. Maybe what you should do is structure it so that it occurs earlier in pieces, and we can interweave it. And I thought, what a great idea, because... it made sense emotionally for this character to have heard these stories over time, and it made sense to hear a portion of the story at a later period in her life.
It's funny because you're one of the few writers, I feel, even though we don't see each other very often, as if our lives have intertwined because, Faith Sale, your editor, has been an influence on me. You introduced me to the work of your writing group's leader.
Molly Giles.
Molly Giles, right.
Yes.
And, up down south of here, there's Sandy Dykstra, who's your agent. And so I've always felt as if I've been privy to the inner workings of this process. Between the time of The Kitchen God's Wife and The 100 Secret Senses, you wrote a screenplay, and I wondered how that influenced writing a novel.
Well, I wanted to go into into screenwriting with the idea that I would learn something about the creative process that would help me in my fiction writing, because I'm not a big fan of film. And I specifically looked at the way that Ron Bass treated scenes and how he went into a scene and how he exited a scene. Not that the two are the same, I mean, knowing what the differences were was also important. Knowing what could be dramatized and what should remain internal, part of internal dialogue just that the narrator would give, was also something that I learned. But I think it was really in looking at the sequence of telling the story that it has to have a certain logical sense that you can almost imagine and picture. A lot of my imagery, a lot of my story comes to me as visual images, and so I'm very much aware of that aspect of storytelling. So the movies really tie into that.
It's interesting because, you know, I've worked in development and film, and so it's with great trepidation that I read a new novel by a novelist who's recently had a binge at the movies, you know. And I felt almost as if in this book that just as its narrator, Olivia, is trying to place herself between half worlds, you know, that she is half Chinese, half Italian, and is being bombarded day and night by the storytelling procedures of her lost or late reclaimed sister, maybe sister, Quan, that in the same way, too, that Amy Tan was dealing with a storytelling procedure that she knows instinctively, inflected with a structure of storytelling that is recently learned.
That's true. I think, you know, I wasn't trained as a fiction writer. I didn't go to a creative writing program. And I feel I'm going to be in training the rest of my life, learning the craft itself. My storytelling really is instinctive. It's intuitive things I have that I have to tame because I can get err on the garrulous side, especially, and learning when to be obtuse. I have this desire to sometimes show the literary critics that I can write something different, you know, and I have to get rid of that egotistical notion, you know, and realize why I write. I don't have the training, the great literary tradition. And so I also have to do a lot of reading of the great masters to learn something about that.
See, I have to tell you that I think that your instincts as a writer are so good. And I never found in the early work a mistake on the garrulous side. I found the writing always sensuous. Here in the 100 Secret Senses, I sensed a hurtling, an attempt to give events as much weight, dramatic weight, as they could bear. And so when I came to the part of the book in which our narrator's husband-to-be is explaining that he lost his girlfriend as she was telling him that she was pregnant and afraid of an abortion and immediately after was swallowed by an avalanche on the ski slopes. I thought, Amy, no! tell me that this isn't happening because it just seemed to me to be such an odd, melodramatic event, the kind of event that you place in to make sure it has, that it leaves its imprint, that it has its effect. And what I had loved and still love in much of the rest of the book are Quan's stories, the sense of things being almost folktales, that a conclusion must be drawn by the reader. And, you know, I thought to myself, this Mr. Bass. I'm going to tell her. I'm going to tell her that this Mr. Bass doesn't know about novels. He knows about movies.
Well, I didn't put that in there so much as dramatics. It's, you know, I actually want to do a talk about someday, write a speech that has to do with what went into the writing of this book. And it is about so-called yin people, people who have died. And I've gone through a lot of death in my life. You know, my father and my brother died when I was 14, but a number of friends who have also died, and I wanted to pay tribute to them. And this, now this is no excuse on a literary level, but I often write things for their own reasons. So it's a valid literary criticism. But I had a friend who, in the middle of an argument, was killed in an avalanche. It was a man instead of a woman. And I wanted to, the image of how he died and what he did to try to save himself and the prayerful position that he was found in has stayed with me. And I just needed to release that ghost from my life and put it into the book.
It's very hard not to use something like that, it seems to me.
Yeah.
But what I noticed, it wasn't exactly the extremity of the incident. It was that I think because if I had to describe your writing as it unfurls sentence by sentence, I would say that it was written in the same way that the planchette on a Ouija board moves, that there's a kind of gliding effect, and that the things that unfurl are consequently rather dreamlike, and that the stories open like flowers. In this, for the first time, maybe because of the intercutting, there seems a lot of get in and get out, you know. And when you say that you were looking at how Ron Bass enters and leaves scenes, I thought to myself, yes, but this isn't her. Her method is more like in film, the long take, letting the camera move so long on its track that it enters an almost dreamlike, blissful zone of swans leaving trails behind. And the movement and the imagery always seem to me themselves to be long glides.
That's interesting. I'll have to see if maybe some of that influence did, you know, kind of change how I got in and out of scenes, chapters, things like that.
I'm talking to Amy Tan about The 100 Secret Senses. And as you say, it is a book about the dead, the yin people. They don't like to be called ghosts.
Yes, politically incorrect these days.
and it's Quan Li, who is capable of seeing ghosts. She's come from China when the narrator is young. She has been the odd, teased, older, unfashionable sister. Kids call her retarded, and Olivia has even done that herself. And the book seems to be about the way in which Quan's dreams and stories turn out to come true for Olivia. In other words, this is a book about fiction turning real. In that way, I suppose it's a metaphysical book. What led you to this?
I know this is going to sound really flaky, but I was so hesitant to write this book because, you know, aware of certain people's reactions to the idea of the supernatural and metaphysical questions that are placed in fiction and the tendency towards sentimentality. But I have had so many experiences in my life that are like this, and it was hard for me to deny them anymore. I felt this constant urging to write this story, not knowing what it was going to be about or that it had something to do with what I believed and how it's based in part on love and hope, how these hopes shape what you believe. So I just let it happen. And the strange part about writing this is that almost daily there were coincidences that happened. Literally books falling off shelves and opening to certain pages and those becoming the direction the book would take. History books that detailed the Taiping Rebellion that I knew very little about and that fit with this setting that I already had in Changmian, south of Guilin. If I wanted to know more about geography, I would find that evening I would be sitting next to somebody at a dinner, a fundraising dinner, and I'd ask what the person did, and he'd say, "I'm a geologist, you know, and I specialize in limestone formations," which is exactly what I was...
Caves.
Yeah, the imagery that I was looking at. No, more specifically when I was looking at, you know, rocks and the rubble that happens with karst formations. And then I would be thinking about caves, you know, and wanting to know more about the things that were found in caves in China, stone villages, which actually have been found in south of Guilin. And I would find that evening that I was meeting the head archaeologist of, you know, China, who knew a lot about caves in Guilin. And that, as much as anything, shaped the direction of this book. Now, a lot of it is, one thing that I'm aware of is that there's so many things in there that are improbable or too many coincidences, and yet that was what was happening during the writing of the book. And I just felt, I'm just going to go with this and let go of this skepticism and this need to do things on a literary level and just see where this story goes, because it was so much intertwined with my life and issues of life and death that I was dealing with. And
I noticed that there are certain artistic questions that enter the book as well. The narrator is a photographer, and she is divided when she goes to China between an impulse to make the kind of pictures that she knows that the travel magazine wants and will accept,
mm-hmm.
and on the other hand, a strong impulse to take photographs of a slop bucket with the flies buzzing
mm-hmm.
around it
mm-hmm.
because she knows it's a better, a truer picture.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, there she is, the problem of Amy Tan writing this book, in a setting with ghosts that, after all, can't be photographed.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed as if throughout the book there's a kind of question of, do I write about the beautiful, the gritty, the unseeable? And it seems to me that that kind of division is there throughout the book, not just American and Chinese, but also China pre and post the Cultural Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, a kind of beautiful, almost fairy tale China,
mm-hmm.
and on the other hand, a devastated China.
Mm-hmm.
Which
mm-hmm.
do you tell?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was this question of perception, belief, reality, emotions, and hopes. Quan sees certain things in Guilin that have changed over time, and Olivia thinks that it's garish and hideous, the kind of progress that's been made. And Quan looks at it and has this astonished look on her face, and Olivia thinks that she's just hugely disappointed with what's happened. Instead, Quan says, "God, it's just so great, so much progress." And yet she also, Quan looks at a mountain that she used to climb, and it was all her hopes, you know, that she would take up to the mountain and release these wild birds that would fly off and take her wishes with her. And when she sees the mountain again, she said, "Oh, that mountain now so small, is that because I've become American now and everything I see is now smaller, poorer, you know, less good?" For me, there was that in life. There's this question of, you know, what do you focus on in life? and how much of what kind of intersection there is between your imagination, your perceptions, and your hopes. What do you see on the basis of what you hope?
It seemed almost as if the book, in a very interesting way, was about what role does fiction have?
Mm-hmm.
If it's just fiction, is it useless and therefore for children?
Mm-hmm.
If it's for children, isn't it important what we tell them anyway?
Mm-hmm.
If it's reality, is this, you know, Frank Chin entering here to say, let's have the real thing. No more folk tales,
mm-hmm.
Amy.
Mm-hmm.
The book seemed to be dealing with all of those questions mm-hmm. on several different levels.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right in thinking?
Well, yeah. In fact, during the writing of this book, I wrote an essay that had to do with, it was called Required Reading and Other Dangerous Subjects. And it had to do with this notion of what is fiction supposed to mean and represent and do? And we've seen this trend in the past to look at fiction as having proscribed meaning or a proscribed task that it must do and sort of explain or educate people on issues like culture or role models, to present role models, to isolate myths and stereotypes. And I wanted at the same time to just simply write a story for the sake of telling a story and see where it went and what questions emotionally they just brought up. And so it's not, you know, the great important political novel, you know, that was something that I was trying to write actually before this book about responsibility, social responsibility, individual responsibility, one's place in the world, intentions and consequences. I found that when I was trying to flog meaning out of a story that way, I didn't have any heart in it. And so I chose to do something that had pure storytelling in it, the fantasy of stuff. And I don't quite agree that the story that Kwan tells is necessarily one that was true. I mean, by the end of the story, Olivia sort of wants to believe the story was true. But there's so many questions about who Kwan really was
mm-hmm.
that it's kind of up to the reader to decide, you know, well, you know, here's a woman in a situation of crisis and personal need, and she makes a leap. But as a reader, you know, it's really to question the meaningfulness of that kind of story in one's own life. But what if it turns out not to be true? I mean, what do you get out of it? Is it completely mm-hmm. meaningless then? Do you feel that you've been lied to? Do you feel that you have a connection still to that person and that history, made up though it was? The larger issue for me had to do with the qualities of love and who we belong to and why. Kwan may not belong to Olivia's family at all. Olivia has no name to which she belongs. She's wondering, did she ever belong to Simon in that sense that we look for in relationship love, you know, in unconditional love? And that was what I got out of writing the book, you know, this, which, you know, certainly crosses paths with the one's cultural identity. To whom do we belong? To what society and culture and community do we belong?
I'm talking to Amy Tan. In almost as an overture to the Joy Luck Club, there's an italicized story about a swan's feather. And by the end of that story, you know, your breath is taken away and you know you're in the right book. At that time, that story is told, and the meaning of that story is allowed to percolate
mm-hmm.
through the length of the book, many stories of mothers and daughters and cultural transmission. Here, I think for the first time in your work, Kwan is telling Olivia what she has to learn. You have to learn to see yin and yang. You have to learn to see both sides of a situation, that a soft song, a place that seems to be called soft song, the translation can also be bitter end or something. But it's the first time that you seem to be telling the reader what the moral lesson is. Do you feel that in the past the work has been misunderstood, or that you feared that this might not be understood? It seemed to be more...
No, I don't... That didn't cross my mind. I think it was more that here are two people who have very different and often strident opinions on the world. And so for Kwan to be less subtle about, I mean, to be subtle about what she believes would have been a different story. For her to discover these
she
things.
She can't help it.
Yeah, no, she's you know, she's going to just tell you what to do. She not only tells her about yin and yang and balance and stuff, she tells her you shouldn't divorce him, you know. I mean, he's great, you know, and handsome. He's, you know, she's full of opinions.
But she's always
she's
right.
on the surface. See, as Olivia said, she everything is on the surface for anyone to see. She's neither deep, you know, nor subtle. And that's the quality of this character.
Would you say that truth is that way too?
Oh, I think truth comes in so many forms. I mean, it's a wonderful thing about truth is that there are no truisms about truth. You can get
there
it subtly.
Only truisms about truth.
Really, that's, yes, exactly. That you know, you come across certain things in life, you realize it gradually, and those become the really visceral epiphanies that you have when you realize it slowly. And there are others that slam you on the head and you don't want to believe them, which is what Kwan does. You know, she just continues to slam Olivia with these ideas, and she says, I'm a sane person, I'm a rational person, I'm not going to believe in this stuff. You know, it's more like a debate that goes on between two characters, but really perhaps are the same, a debate that I had, you know, between this world of imagination without any boundaries and the other that has to look at things a little more with a straightforward eye.
I've been speaking to Amy Tan, the author most recently of The 100 Secret Senses, published recently by Putnam. Thank you for joining me again.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Theo Mondel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
Too.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse Podcast.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.